CEO for the Hopkins podcast on foreign affairs. My name is Olivia Brown. I'm an international studies computer science double major, and I'm the guest on today's show.
Thank you very much, indeed. My name is Zachary Wheeler. I'm another host for the Hopkins podcast on foreign affairs.
And my name is Franz. I'm the other co-host.
My name is Megan Rudkai, and I am the third co-host.
This week, we're going to discuss a really interesting issue. Cyber conflict and cyber war. What is it? Will it occur in the future? These are the questions that we hope to answer in this podcast. The structure of the podcast will be sort of as follows. We're going to start with six basic premises. Six premises that we believe will thoroughly outline what we mean when we say the words cyber conflict, cyber war. We hope this will give you a general understanding of the topic at hand. Following that, we're going to outline some empirical examples of cyber conflict in the past. And to be honest, these are insane. You might have heard of them before, you might have not. We're going to talk about things like the sabotaging of nuclear centrifuges, the complete takedown of the UK's health system, and even the hacking of the US 2016 elections. You've probably heard of that one. Following the empirical examples, we're going to go right into some discussions of what the future of the world looks like in a world filled with cyber conflict and how we could possibly regulate or address the issue of cyber conflict. So we really hope you enjoy the podcast, and I hope you have a blast listening to it.
So the first premise starts out by saying that cyber is not just sort of a world unto itself, sort of subordinate to other realms of international relations theory. No, the first premise is that cyber conflict is a new arena of military warfare, on par with land warfare, sea warfare, air, and space. So developed militaries in states, they rely entirely on these cyber capabilities to command strikes. They depend on cyber capabilities to monitor their systems. And then even states themselves in civilian life, you know, the financial sector depends on computers. Business sector, transportation, health, water, public services, it all depends on cyber coordination. And that presents, you know, cyber has revolutionized everything. That presents a huge vulnerability that states and militaries can exploit. And so that's why cyber is the new realm of military.
And that is correct, Megan. And that actually brings us to our second premise, which is cyber conflict has a real and highly dangerous consequences. Because just as Megan said, technology has been ingrained in our society from our financial activities to our academic work, to communications, to our energy systems. The United States relies heavily on its technology. So if a state actor or non-state actors can breach that, it can have catastrophic consequences for energy supplies, for our communication systems, and just for our lives overall. That said, in order to prevent this from happening, in order to prevent this from spiraling out of control, we need to try and build a multilateral and collaborative approach to this problem, one that all countries and all non-state actors are happy with. And Olivia, would you like to run through the third premise?
Sure. The third premise is that states are now becoming more and more of a primary actor in cyber espionage, sabotage, and propaganda, meaning that this multilateral approach that Franz earlier mentioned is starting to become a reality. The 400-pound Chuck isn't really the main threat to critical infrastructure anymore. The state military units are. So state military units can be the U.S. cybercom, like NASA, the Russian GRU, the cyber unit of the PLA, the Israeli cyber forces, the North Korean cyber task force, and even more. So basically what this means is that states are now building cyber weapons via military task forces, and the launch of those cyber weapons on other nations and other nations' private industries is becoming more and more of a reality, more and more of an option that militaries can use going forward, which really goes back to the first premise about how cyber is the new military arena. And I think that brings us into our fourth premise.
Premise number four deals with what cyber attacks have been targeting. In specific, cyber attacks target what we call critical infrastructure. Critical infrastructure is defined as devices paramount in protecting national security, operating the economy, and establishing public well-being. So what exactly is an example of critical infrastructure? Well, there are 10 different sectors. So that is energy, health, transport, financial, information and communications technology, water, food, public legal order and safety, chemical and nuclear industry, and space and research. Those are the critical infrastructure. So, for example, the power grid is part of the critical infrastructure. Hospitals are part of critical infrastructure. Food, like agriculture, farms, that's critical infrastructure. The problem is that the biggest targets for cyber attacks right now, how you do the most damage with cyber attacks, is by targeting this critical infrastructure. And that is what we've seen in the past. Critical infrastructure such as nuclear energy facilities have been targeted. And yeah, so that's premise number four. Premise number five.
All right, so the fifth premise is that there's tension between private industries and governments regarding cyber defense. And this comes from the fact that private industries believe in this Silicon Valley libertarianism, which, you know, makes them think that they have a responsibility to their customers to protect their information from everyone. I mean, from my understanding, not even these companies aren't even allowed to know their customers' information sometimes. That's how closely they protect this information. So that's it. We see this come to a head in 2016 or 2015, the Sam
Bernardino.
Sounds about right.
Yeah,
somewhere in there.
In the Sam Bernardino shooting.
Right.
When the FBI tried to get Apple to unlock the shooter's phone. But Apple, for months, just because it didn't want to break the encryption on the phone, thus weakening everyone else's encryption, refused to do it. So the FBI had to go to court, and the judge had to order Apple to open the phone.
Well, somewhat. So it's actually even more nuanced than that, Franz. So Apple at the time didn't have the capabilities to unlock the encryption of the phone. Like, the entire phone is encrypted, and Apple does not have a key to unencrypt it.
Right? That's so intentional.
Intentional, right? Mm. So that when the government calls and says, hey, we have a subpoena, we want this information, Apple can say, dude, we can't even get you the information.
Like, sorry, not sorry.
Right, yeah. Exactly. So what happened was Apple, since they didn't want to make this encryption key, essentially told the government, like, we cannot possibly do this, and it worked. Like, the government could not subpoena them because they cannot get in the phone in the first place. So the government eventually went to an Israeli company, and the Israeli company hacked this phone and got into it. So it's kind of interesting, like, the whole argument about encryption versus government government rights.
As I recall, just as I was, like, reading the news feed about it, wasn't it, like, a federal judge, you know, put out the subpoena, and then Apple was deciding whether or not to, you know, agree to the subpoena? And it was sort of like, you know, what is Apple going to do? Is this going to set off a huge, you know, precedent. Court battle, precedent, everything? And before Apple could make the decision, the FBI said, never mind, we're in. We hired the Israelis. You know, no decision needed. That right. sort
but
of avoided exactly. that
but
whole yes.
But
as
Nikki Haley once said, we're taking names.
Yeah. Oh, so that court battle could be coming. We'll wait for that to rear its
all right,
ugly
yeah.
head later.
I think it definitely is coming. I think with the onset of cyber and every aspect of society, you're going to have these court cases. Like, they're not going to go away. Like, this is going to cause, like, yeah. a constitutional battle, especially with the Fourth Amendment.
Can you tell us what the Fourth Amendment says?
Do you want, like, word for word, or
search and seizure.
Basically, just the fact that a private citizen has the right to privacy is pretty much what the Fourth Amendment says, and that right. like
now here's the key thing, right? Is unless the government has a warrant,
right?
Which
right,
Apple
has to be lawful. Just, like, there's
a lawfully acquired warrant,
right, which then you get into the FISA courts.
Yeah,
and the FISA courts are what allows government to surveil people, and that's what Edward Snowden leaked. But it is quite complicated. We're going to get into that argument. We're going to get there. But we don't want to jump the gun.
That said, Megan, do you want to run us through the last and final premise?
All right. So the sixth premise is that cyber warfare at this point really is, as President Barack Obama said, the wild, wild west. There are no international treaties that say that a cyber, you know, act of aggression is an act of war, or if it isn't. And so that leaves it up to individual states, you know, when states attack each other using cyber warfare tactics, to decide, you know, this is war, yeah. we're going to go to war, or it's not war, or, you know, it's just, there's a lot of gray area since it's pretty new and it has not been legislated yet. So that leaves it up to us and our generation to sort out what is war when it's online.
Okay. Thank you, Megan.
Now we're going to talk a little bit about some empirical examples of cyber attacks that have taken place in the past. So we've outlined the premises. What is cyber war? What is cyber conflict? Here are some examples. So number one is WannaCry. This was this is an example of a state-conducted cyber attack. This was 2017. Some of you might remember it, some of you might not, but it actually was a really big deal. It's been like front page of the New York Times for about 3 days. It's essentially this form of virus called ransomware, where you download the program, it hijacks your computer, and it encrypts all your files and then tells you that if you don't pay X amount of money in Bitcoin, it deletes all your files. So this virus spread through pretty much the entirety of the world, which is insane. But it struck these really significant places, specifically critical infrastructure of Great Britain, right? So the United Kingdom with their National Health Service is a really big deal. Like it's, you know, everyone talks about that. You know, won't even get into domestic politics, but whatever. The NHS.
Franz is shaking his head.
Franz is crying right now.
But, wanna cry.
Anyways. So the NHS was completely shut down by this ransomware because no one could access the medical records of patients. They went back to literal pen and paper, which is insane. So 300,000 computers were affected in over 150 different countries, which include the NHS and also parts of the Brazilian government, which is insane. So that's WannaCry. It was really interesting. Eventually, it was stopped on like by accident by a random guy in California who like found a flaw in the code. Really interesting. Go look that up. Megan, you want to talk a little bit about Stuxnet or Olivia or whoever would like to take it?
Olivia. Sure, yeah. So Stuxnet was conducted by the U.S. And Israel. It was a joint operation. And basically, it was crippling the nuclear centrifuge operation in the Iranian... Natanz nuclear facility. Just because we didn't really want them to have nuclear weapons, which, yeah, if you want to learn more about that, you can look more in the history. There's a lot. It goes pretty far back, probably into, like, the 1940s of just, like, history of... relationships between those two countries. But essentially it worked by there was a step with the infection that it entered a system via a USB stick, which is pretty primitive in the computer science world. That you
job.
Yeah, it did the job, but it was you can definitely see that especially now, like cyber attacks are getting more and more
sophisticated.
Which makes it terrifying, considering how much damage that just this one USB drive really did to their nuclear centrifuge. But it definitely did the job. So it started with an infection, and then it went to a search, which checks whether a given machine is part of the targeted industrial control system. And then it went to an update part of it, where if the system wasn't a target, then the Stuxnet did nothing. If it is, then the worm attempts to access the internet and then download a more recent version of itself, which is a really interesting if-else statement in computer science. I can already see that this is, like, written by, like, a computer science, like, person. And then this fourth step was compromise, which the worm would then compromise the target system's logic controllers, which exploited a zero-day vulnerabilities, software weaknesses that were not identified by the security experts themselves. And then it would go into a control stage where it would pretty much just, like, take over the control. So in the beginning, the spies on the operations of the targeted systems would just, like, start spying. And then it would use the information gathered to take control of the centrifuges and make them spin themselves to failure, effectively ruining the Iranian nuclear facility. And then which brings us to the sixth step of deceive and destroy. So it works objectively pretty well, starting from a USB port, which is kind of terrifying considering that this is 2008-2011, and now me, a computer science major in our sophomore year of 2018, is shocked that it really just started with one USB port.
Yeah,
essentially the thing with Stuxnet was like, well, first of all, it allegedly was conducted by the U.S. and Israel. It's never been confirmed by the United States government. Like, but
okay.
There's a lot of winks in there. All right?
But at the same time, how many things out there in international politics have never been confirmed by the U.S.
Right,
government.
Right.
But
I feel like there's more things that are allegedly in the U.S. than the U.S. will ever take credit for. Like, it's like 90% alleged and the 10% that the U.S. actually takes credit for.
No matter who did it, this bug was not accidental. Somebody wanted Iran's, you know, centrifuges to fail.
We're seeing about 50 years. Because every 50 years,
everything gets declassified. It happens. So regardless, the important part about Stuxnet was that this was a computer virus that actually affected the production of centrifuges and nuclear fuel in a foreign country. All right. So we didn't have to bomb the Iranian nuclear facility. We didn't have to militarily attack it. We sent a piece of code. And it destroyed part of its production for a couple of years. And
for
there's
like
debate about it debated about like how much it actually worked. But that's where we're at with cyber weapons, all right? So cyber weapons really do have these tangible effects. They can shut down the entire like health system of the United Kingdom. They can destroy the centrifuges of a foreign nation. It's crazy.
But when you talk about using cybersecurity to like destroy a centrifuge, for example, is different from, you know, a hospital. But is that even better sometimes than diplomacy that doesn't work? Is that better than an airstrike to just quietly shut down nuclear production where you don't want it to be?
A good question, Megan. A good question.
I'm leaving
indeed.
That out there.
A lot of people would argue that an airstrike would be more effective.
I mean,
because like Iran. Oh.
Well,
like
then the centrifuge is gone. But if you want to be sneaky about it, and there are advantages to being sneaky about it.
Yeah, that is true. But Iran has. I mean, their nuclear weapons just bad. The nuclear weapons program is back up and running.
Yeah.
I mean, now they are limited by the terms of the Iran deal, but I mean, more
or
less.
Who knows? Maybe there's a virus working its way through the centrifuges right now. They don't know it yet.
Oh, it's dormant.
Yeah, apparently we tried this on North Korea, but it didn't work because North Korea, like, has no computers that it can spread to. Like, seriously, not kidding. Like, it worked in. That's one part of cyber war is that. We're going to talk about this, but the most vulnerable nations are also the most powerful and developed nations, right? So the United States has more critical infrastructure than any other country in the world connected to the internet, which means there's more abilities and more targets for other countries to hit, whereas a country like North Korea, which doesn't have computers and like for a vast majority of the population is not as vulnerable.
The U.S. has everything to lose, whereas North Korea has not much to lose, and North Korea can throw rocks at whatever it wants and
and have no consequences.
It's peasant farmers keep going. They don't know. They don't know anything.
All right, Megan, you want to talk a little bit about our next empirical example?
Sure.
NotPetya.
So moving on to NotPetya, this was arguably the largest, most expensive cyber attack in history. This was an attack probably by the Russians. I don't think the Russians
There's
have ever confirmed
there.
It. There's, we're going to say it was by the Russians attacking the Ukrainian electric facilities, and it spread indiscriminately to corporations around the world and especially in Ukraine. So a top Trump administration cyber official confirmed up to $10 billion in global damages just from NotPetya. NotPetya hit 4 hospitals in Kiev alone, 6 power companies, 2 airports, more than 22 Ukrainian banks, ATMs, and almost every federal agency in Ukraine. So you can see how there would be huge international backlash if Russia invaded Ukraine, which, you know, that's its own tricky thing. But Russia,
bad day for that.
Bad day. But Russia can, you know, totally incapacitate Ukraine by doing this, and there's going to be less international backlash, I feel like, because, one, there's no international treaty saying that this is an act of war. It's just sort of mean. And there's also, I feel like people in general have less of an understanding of cyber warfare. They see a missile and they see dead people and the public is angry. But if they see a cyber attack, well, you can't see a cyber attack.
Right. And that's what's crazy about it, too, is like you have this problem of there's this insane amount of damage, $10 billion in damage. I mean, you have this Ukrainian official saying, quote unquote, the government was dead because of this cyber attack. But nothing happens, and you can't attribute it. And there's even deeper problems. So cyber attacks are indiscriminate, right? They target both civilians and the government and private banks and private enterprises, right? Whereas in normal war, unless it's World War II or something like that, mm-hmm. it tends to not do so, right? You, like, there's laws of war in which you cannot target civilians, but cyber attacks do so. So it's a really gray area.
Like, or you launch a missile and it hits one target.
Right.
But then it's like if you launched a missile and then that missile it became bounces. Like 10 missiles, like bounced over to like your allied country that's next door, bounced over everywhere.
So this is a really big issue. Franz or Olivier, would you like to talk about the Sony attacks?
So this is now like state attacks, not on other states, but on like private corporations.
Right. So I remember, I think it was in 2016, Sony had plans to release a movie called,
Interview.
The Interview with James Franco.
Oh my gosh.
It was basically
one big parody of the North Korean government. And you know, North Korea being the hermit state that it is and being the reactive state that it is, did not like this. So they decided to, did they warn Sony or did they just decided to hack it?
They told Sony, don't release it.
Yeah.
And Sony, of course, did.
And Sony's just like, no.
Sony didn't know that there was going to be a cyber attack on the end of that.
So Sony releases the movie, and then North Korea hacks Sony, basically hijacking unreleased movies and their computer systems. It literally reduced Sony to pen and paper for like a full working week.
Right.
And it just wiped out $100 million.
They're just so upset about Seth Rogen's performance.
To be fair, if it had been about America, that would like a similar movie. That was a terrible movie.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if we'd. Yeah. Who? It's questionable. Maybe we're launching cyber attacks against like some Russian film company right now, like as we speak.
Yeah.
Who knows? Well, that's the thing. We have no idea. We have no idea.
I feel like the United States has been. Well, we'll get more into it in the questions. Mm-hmm. Zach, do you want to run through the last empirical example?
So our last empirical example we're going to talk about before we get into some discussion is the Iranian attack on Saudi Aramco. So this was in 2012. This one's kind of a more niche one, like less people know about this, but was actually really major. It was one of the kind of first instances, well, besides Stuxnet, but at the time people didn't really know what Stuxnet was. One of the first instances of really massive damage caused by cyber attack. So this was 2012. 35,000 computers were wiped or partially destroyed of Saudi Aramco. And this was an attack by Iran. And like I read this book by a lot of the information in this podcast comes from this book, The Perfect Weapon by David Zanger. And in the book, he talks about how like literally people were scrambling, like, okay, so the IT professionals in the building of Saudi Aramco saw that there was this virus hitting the computers, and they ran across the entire building and physically unplugged every single computer to try to contain the virus, but it didn't work. It had spread immediately. And so this company was absolutely destroyed. They had to start giving out oil for free, because oil was still pumping, but they couldn't sell it or record transactions, and they need to get rid of it. So they literally gave it out for free at a certain point. And supposedly this took like actual months for the entire computer system to come back online, because every hard drive was wiped. There's all these crazy stories. But the point of these empirical examples is just really to reiterate, cyber war and cyber conflict is real, and it's dangerous, and it has consequences, right? Like, that's the problem here, and there's really no attribution, there's no international agreements. It's, as Barack Obama said, it's the Wild West, and something has to be done about it.
And there's one before moving on to questions, there's one big caveat to mention that we haven't mentioned, and I guess a lot of people must have in mind, and that is the Russia's interference in the 2016 election. The reason we're not mentioning that is that there's no proof that a hack was done, but there is proof that Russia did a misinformation campaign on Facebook.
For sure.
What? No, there's proof a hack was done.
No, there's
they hacked the DNC.
They hacked the DNC and they hacked actually
the DCCC or something
DNC.
Like that.
However, when it comes to the election, they didn't hack the election. At least there's no proof that they hacked the election. However, there
like
is
the voting machines.
The voting machines.
They didn't hack the voting machines. Right?
Yeah. Now they did engage in very pretty heavy voter misinformation campaigns through Facebook, and it's actually
Olivia, would you like to speak about the DNC hack?
Weigh in.
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, I think that anything that hacks anything pertaining to our elections, anything pertaining to America's democracy, is a attack on America itself. Like, I think that the DNC hack would qualify as, like, partially hacking our elections just because it, I don't know, it definitely had an effect on who people voted for. And I definitely think that Facebook, even if it's just misinformation, I think that that should honestly be considered a cyber attack. I think that the issue really that we've all pretty much touched on is that there are no laws, there are no policies, there are no, like, international agreements upon what is a cyber attack, what is a cyber warfare. And it's really interesting to me, this is a bit of a tangent, but even Hollywood is realizing how big of an issue this is. Like, they're, like, TV shows are showing this. Like, it's been on, like, Grey's Anatomy, like, Designated Survivor. Like, it's everywhere. Like, cyber attacks are everywhere except for protecting against them in policy.
And that is actually a great segue to our questions, because I'm going to ask a question that is not in the question sheet.
Yes, so loud, very loud.
Because, I mean, we run into this question. Let's first start domestically. Does the United States have the institutions to even deal with this? Like, is the Fourth Amendment up to date to deal with such an issue? Is the U.S. Constitution up to date with such an
Are you saying, do we have the capabilities to defend?
The legal institutions, the constitutional institutions.
To legislate this.
So that's a question.
Take the coders out of it. Do we have the legislators who understand it well enough and who can...
No.
Here's a problem.
All right, so critical infrastructure. A lot of it is state-owned, but a lot of it's private, too.
Yeah.
Most of it's private. Like, healthcare industry, electrical grids, that's all private.
Electrical grid?
Yeah, private.
Probably partly private, at least.
I don't know. Who knows? But a lot of it's private. Yeah. So the question is, when there's a cyber attack on a private corporation, is it the government's duty to defend those private corporations? And do those private corporations want the government to intervene in their place? Or should there be, there's also lots of private cybersecurity firms, and that's like this, I'm taking a class, global governance. Essentially, there's a whole global domain of private corporations that are fighting cybercrime that's not governments. But if a government is attacking another private institution, is it the, like, okay, so think about it this way. If North Korea launched a missile and it hit Sony, destroying everything, like, obviously the government will get involved. But that's what happened in the Sony attacks, but the U.S. government didn't do anything because it was not technically an attack on the United States. It was an attack on this private corporation. But there is a difference, I guess, because no one died in the Sony attacks.
And I don't think Sony and Sony's movies are critical infrastructure. I think that's the huge difference, that Sony is not necessarily vital to American interests. It's a huge affront to America in general to attack an American company like that.
Right.
But it didn't, you know, North Korea did not turn off the lights in Washington, D.C. when it went after Sony.
Right.
But I think if North Korea went after our electrical grid or anything like that, something vital to our public national interests, I think that is when
the
U.S. government has to step in and protect those private industries. Doesn't matter.
Right.
If industry is performing that critical function, I think it needs to allow the government to protect that critical function for its people.
And here's why I asked that question. Because currently, the Fourth Amendment protects a lot of companies and a lot of people from just the government protecting them, right? And this has been a huge issue. No, it has been a huge issue in the courts because, like, the U.S. government, just for matters of national security, sometimes needs the private companies' cooperation, and sometimes private companies don't cooperate. And I think that's a key difference. Sony was not a matter of national security. But the Sam Bernardino—that's the hardest word.
The Apple Sam Bernardino. That's the funny line between national security and not, because he might have been a lone wolf. But what if he had connections to a whole ring that the U.S. needed to know about?
All right. Well, this brings us to Edward Snowden.
Oh.
Right. So Edward Snowden, he essentially was a contractor for Booz Allen Hamilton. And he had a bunch of security clearances with the NSA, and he took a program, scraped a bunch of information from the NSA, and then released it to the world to see. And what he revealed was that the U.S. government has, like, a ton of different programs spying on both private institutions and individuals of the United States through their cyber communication. So this is when the whole idea of metadata came out, and the whole idea of...
What, like, is metadata? Is that just big
metadata?
Metadata
is like recording not what a call says, but the fact that a call took took place.
Between who?
Between people. Yeah. And so, yeah, between who exactly. And, yeah, so all, Edward Snowden revealed all of this. So, and a lot of people saw this as the U.S. government infringing upon Fourth Amendment rights as citizens. Right? Which is very reasonable. I mean, I think that's
it
true.
Depends.
But frauds would disagree. Oh, okay. But, so anyways, when we get back down to the security aspect of it, essentially, where is government overreach? Like, at what point is the line? And that's a really sticky question. But I don't want to get too bogged down in the weeds. So does anyone else want to talk about maybe cyber sanctions or FISA courts? Or do we want to keep talking about...
I want to talk about sort of asymmetric security in this case. We sort of touched on it, how, you know, North Korea can train, you know, a bunch of, you know, 400-pound chucks, you know, at very little expense to take down American infrastructure. And, you know, so the question is, realism is one, you know, international relations theory that says that big countries, rich countries with a lot of infrastructure, a lot of military, they are the strongest because they have those things. But the cyber threat says that big countries with all those good things are actually going to be the weakest countries because they have the most to lose. And this is just fascinating to me. Is realism dead?
Right, and I actually wrote an entire paper about this last year.
Go off, Zach.
Oh my God, I can go off. But it is fascinating. So realism says that power is security, right? Like the more military might you have, the more technological capabilities you have, the more, the better you are. But where we are now, as Megan just said, is North Korea is more safe from cyber attacks than the United States or the European Union or whatever. And it's interesting. So is realism dead? Well, no. It depends on how you define power.
And,
right? So maybe power isn't necessarily like technological advantage now, right? Like power still equals security. You just have to define power differently. So maybe realism is not dead. It's just you have to rethink how realism, you know, acts out in the world.
And there definitely is a way to make technology secure. We just obviously haven't gotten there yet with all these attacks. But I think that once something is attacked, like, you realize that it needs to be more secure. I'm just worried personally about that, an infrastructure is going to be attacked before we've put the security in place. That's really the issue.
Right.
We need
to
get ahead of it. We're just not, because
people are often driven by disasters.
Yeah.
People are often driven to act by disasters. And that's what we saw after 9/11.
Right, it's reactive.
In 9/11, I remember... You know how you can only walk through security if you have a ticket? Before 9/11, like family members could literally wait outside of the gate.
Yep.
Right? And then after 9/11, they started, you know, putting all those stuff.
Yeah, there's this talk of the cyber Pearl Harbor. Like, seriously, that's the, like, what the rhetoric is
about.
Yeah.
To your point about the asymmetric security, I feel like these small states only hold an advantage as long as the state that they attacked cannot recover.
Right.
Because as soon as they recover, like, they're going to use their actual military power to respond.
Right.
And at that point, there's like, no competition there.
That's a big assumption, though, to assume that if
they
North Korea...
Recover.
Well, to assume that if North Korea launches a cyber attack against the U.S., I mean, it depends what the severity is, but will the U.S. have like, the international support, the public support to wage war on North Korea, or,
I feel like
especially in a nuclear situation like what we have now.
And there's this deniability, right? So remember, Russia hacked the elections of the United States. But you have...
They
hacked the elections.
They influenced and hacked the DNC.
Yes, and we will never know whether or not it changed the vote. But the official government line is they hacked the elections. They did. They hacked the DNC. They leaked John Podesta's
emails. Simplified
everyone.
Language.
But no. They really, no. The official government line is they did hack the elections. Like, you can go to NSA, go to the Department of Homeland Security. All of them say Russia hacked the elections. That's the official government line. You can debate on whether or not that affected the outcome, but the fact that they did. So, okay, anyways. But there's this plausible deniability, right? Like, Russia can say, oh, it wasn't us. There's no return address to a cyber attack. Well, there is, but there's no visible.
It's trickier. It's more
difficult to trace where a cyber attack came from than a projectile that has an arc, right? Like it's not impossible, but there's always this plausible deniability, and that's the problem. Is how do you get the public to rally around? Oh well, you know, Russia probably hacked our elections, yada, 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 versus, oh, Russia literally sent a missile and destroyed voting machines or something like that. You know, it's difficult. And that's a question that should be addressed, is how to respond to cyber attacks. Do you respond asymmetrically? Like, Franz thinks we should drop bombs.
No, I never said that. Okay, never mind, never mind. I never said that. I said that, I mean, that realism comes back as soon as the other power can go back on its feet. Like, they're just not going to, you know, go without power for a week and say, like, oh, we forgive you.
So, you know? And I think we've been talking a lot about, you know, the cyber attack comes first. How do you respond? What about when the U.S. imposes, you know, economic trade restrictions on China and China responds by, you know, revitalizing its cyber attacks on U.S. companies, stealing patented information so that they can grow it in their own country and then challenge those U.S. companies later? You know, since Trump imposed those tariffs, you know, we've seen a lot more Chinese cyber attacks against the U.S., against U.S. corporations. And so even if, you know, a conflict doesn't start with cyber warfare, it can, you know, it can be advanced through cyber warfare.
Right, right. And yeah, it's a whole new realm of war, right? A whole new arena.
Yeah, and it's unfortunately, and this is what I believe, it's going to take a disaster for the world to fix it.
Right.
Well, it's interesting because, like, you can even see, like, disasters are currently happening, but because it's so hard to trace, like, you can't get people to rally around it because you can't be like, oh, this person did this in this exact way. You can't get public opinion around it, and that's why you can't do, like, you can't get the funds to do it. You can't get the military behind it. You can't get anything to really change how they're working yet.
I feel like cybersecurity has the same, it comes in the same colors as environmental policies, global policies.
Right, it's abstract.
One is abstract, and the other's like, you need to get everyone to agree on the same thing, and then trust each other.
Right, there's gotta be trust.
Like,
and the I mean, there. Let's be real. Is there ever gonna be like an actual cyber treaty? I mean, who knows? But right now, it's not looking like it. Like, there's really no push for it right now. Like,
let's get together and agree not to cyber, you know, attack each other.
And how do you know? Like, you can't monitor computers of every person in the world, like, seeing what code they write. Like, it's very, very nuanced. And that's the problem that policymakers, like, professionals and, like, you know, journalists are facing right now is, like, we don't know what to do. Like, it's the Wild West. And it's going to take some serious thinking to figure out how to solve this problem.
It's all just gonna.
The good thing about it is that at least it's not as bad as the nuclear dilemma, because when it comes to a nuclear dilemma and defending against nukes, you run into the laws of physics. You know, like that's why Reagan couldn't do his SDI program, or like why that's why defense systems are so inaccurate, because like the laws of physics make it almost impossible.
Right.
But there's a possibility for computer scientists like Olivia to develop systems, like the
Olivia,
defense
you
systems,
save us.
Well,
about to protect us from cyber security.
Sort of on that point, and back to yours, Zach, is the fact that even the people in policy, like you don't just need the people in policy and like cyber and all these people in infrastructure and like energy and health to all come together. You need them to all understand each other, which is a huge thing. Like, you even saw when Mark Zuckerberg, like, went to Congress and the guy was like...
And he sat on his little...
And the guy was like, how do you make Facebook profitable? Like, how do you make money off of Facebook? And he's like, well, we sell ads. Like, there's just a disconnect. There's a transitory disconnect where people just don't understand how these things work. And I think you need understanding before you're going to find a treaty.
And also, I mean, not only understanding, but I feel like it's... Cybersecurity, I feel like, is one of those issues that cannot be handled by Congress. It's like, in that sense...
You think Congress is too old, too discordant?
Not only that, I think it's too political. Because I feel like it should honestly just be handed over to computer scientists, put into a room...
Correct? Well, I don't know about that. Like, as a computer scientist, like, I'm going to tell you right now, we have this one class that they require BSs to take, and it's called computer ethics, and that's it. Like, my data structures class, we're learning about all of these, like, different data structures, and there's never a concern about whether or not we should be doing something, whether or not, like, the implications of it. Right. We're just concerned about how we do it and, like, how to implement it. Like, we don't ever wonder what if. Like, there's not the same, like, realization of consequences that you get in international studies classes or political science classes. So I don't know if it should just be handed over to computer scientists. I think you need other people in the room.
That's a self-sabotage by Miss Olivia Brown.
Hey, I'm a double major, so.
Hey, true.
Yeah.
Unfortunately, Franz and Megan had to leave the conversation early, but I just want to do a quick recap on what we talked about today and where we're going in the future. So we gave you guys the six premises of cyber conflict. So cyber conflict is a new arena of military warfare. Cyber conflict has real and dangerous consequences. States are the primary actors in cyber conflict. Critical infrastructure is the greatest risk of cyber conflict. There is tension between private industries and governments regarding cyber defense. And last but not least, cyber conflict is the wild, wild west. So after those premises, we gave you guys some empirical examples, which I think are the coolest. It's just interesting to talk about these things because, honestly, most people that I speak to on campus don't understand that these cyber attacks have taken place. They really haven't. And it is a huge issue in international affairs right now, cyber conflict. And we want to talk about it more. So that's where we're at now. We close with some discussion questions. We definitely have a lot more to talk about. If you are interested in discussing with the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs, please hit us up. You can email us at Hopkins, POFA@gmail.com. Also, follow us on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Hopkins, POFA. Here's Olivia to close us out.
Hey guys, me again. Thank you so much for listening today to the Hopkins Podcast on Foreign Affairs. I've had a great time. I hope you guys had a great time listening. Thanks.